On today's podcast, Tape 38, Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart and his magic band.
Trust the Wizards present Robert Pollard's Guide to the Late 60s. Before going on tour with his band, Guided by Voices, in 2001, Robert Pollard recorded his favourite records onto 62 double-sided cassettes. Music from 1966 to 1971, from the best-known bands of the era to obscure, unheard-of psychedelic curios. The Wizards are on a mission to listen to and explore every groove. Kicker and Chorizo invite you to turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream as you listen to Robert Pollard's Guide to the Late 60s.
Trout Mask Replica, then, an absolute behemoth of avant-garde music, released on June the 16th, 1969, recorded between August 68 and March 69, produced by Frank Zappa. According to Wikipedia, it was recorded following, in quotes, 8 months of intense rehearsals. We'll come back to that.
Like this pod?
Yes, indeed, yeah. And you got Captain Beefheart on vocals. Not much actual harmonica on this. They've all got nicknames given to them by Mr. Beefheart. John French, or John Drumbo French, is the drummer, also really the arranger of all this stuff. Jeff Cotton, aka Antennae Jimmy Siemens, on guitar, lots of slide guitar, credited as a steel appendage guitar. They use metal picks on this album. Zoot Horn Rollo, Bill Harkleroad, according to his driving license, on the other guitar. Mark Boston on bass guitar, Rocket Morton, as he was known in this band, and Victor Hayden, a.k.a. the Mascara Snake, on bass clarinet and a little bit of vocals here and there. There's a few other people who pop up on one or two songs, but that's basically the core band that are recording it. And they... I've been doing a bit of a deep dive into the background of this.
The 7 months period.
Well, at 8 months of intense, I've done nothing else. I've just been feeding myself on one cup of beans a day. But I must give a shout out to a guy called Samuel Andreev, who's a musician himself. And if you really want to know a lot about this album, I strongly recommend Samuel Andreev's podcast, which you can listen to at samuelandreev.com. He has interviewed all the major players on this album, all the ones who are still with us, John Drumbo French, Jeff Cotton, Mark Boston, Bill Harkleroad, and each podcast interview is like an hour and a half long. I was mostly interested in the drums and the guitar, so I've listened to the Jeff Cotton and the John Drumbo French episodes, also done a bit of reading around John French's book, and they're both absolutely compelling listening. And I kind of think, a little bit like an earlier episode we did on Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young, for me this album's a bit like that one, in that I'm far more fascinated by the backstory than I am by the actual music.
Yes, I mean, the actual music, though, is quite interesting, don't you think? And more for me, well, I don't know how it's thought of generally, but for me, listening to this, I have been spending quite a lot of time with the album over the last week or 2 weeks even. It's all about the lyrics for me. The lyrics are brilliant, absolutely brilliant, such that I find myself quoting random people in the street have been approached by me, and I'll say something like, "My smile is stuck." I don't know, "Hoi hoi." I mean, this is now common parlance, "hoi hoi," in my house, to be fair.
That's how you greet your housemates, your family, yeah. Is it?
Yeah, some say family, yeah. And, you know, a squid eating dough in a polythene bag is
fast and bulbous. That's right,
yeah, the snake. Got me.
Fast and bulbous. Also a tin teardrop. Well, fast and bulbous also tapered, is actually a very good description of my never regions. The book, The 1001 Albums Before You Die, of course this album is in there. And I'll read you a little bit of what it says about the actual music in here. The double album's 28 tracks are generally seen as too testing for most, with the freewheeling approach to composition and lyrics bewildering the casual listener. However, Zappa's tight control behind the desk helps form an abstract canvas for the captain's flight of lyrical fantasy, with Moonlight in Vermont, Neon Meat, Dream of an Octopish, and Old Fart at Play amongst the most memorable. And I think that comes back to what you were saying about the lyrics. I find the music quite interesting as well. I think I said of Safe as Milk on the last episode of this podcast, I said something that the music was too weird to be interesting. Not weird enough to be interesting, some of it.
Mm.
I said some of it's not weird enough to be interesting. This one is definitely weird. It's
too weird.
It's definitely interesting, but the weirdness takes it off into another realm completely. I think musically, it's a bit too weird to want to listen to it for pleasure.
Well, I'm going to question that, because I think you certainly can't have it on as background. I mean, that's never going to work, is it? But I think if you immerse yourself into the world of this album and you don't listen to anything else, I think you get used to the... I don't even know what the terms are, but the anti-music.
Yes.
Or whatever it is.
Anti-music. Johnny Rotten called it that. He's a big fan of this album. Yeah. He called it anti-music.
And once you get beyond the fact that it doesn't sound like anything else, really.
Yes.
I think you can, and I have, enjoyed listening to it. I mean, I can honestly say I've enjoyed listening to it more this time than when I've previously had a go at listening to it, when it's been, oh God, that's quite hard.
Yeah.
You've got to commit.
Well, I have committed, and I've spent a long time with it, but I think that part of it, the weirdness being a bit too much, so whereas the very early stuff is not weird enough. So I've then gone on to listen, because I know you Clear Spot is your favourite album, so I gave that one a listen.
Yeah.
I've listened to a few others, Blue Jeans and Moonbeams and Ice Cream for Crow. And I've found out, for me, the perfect balance of weirdness and listenability, if that's a word, is the Goldilocks album, for me, is the one Shiny Beast Back Chain Puller. Because that's just about weird enough, but it's also quite listenable, and especially the drumming. You know, the part that's I find difficult is the polyrhythmic of it. I've got no problem with the music being all abstract, the melodies, if you can call them that, being abstract, but it's the polyrhythmic nature of it that I just find it very difficult to get a grip on it in any way, or get my head round it, because it's so confusing when there's all these different things going on at once. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit more about the background to it, because I think there's some
interesting... you seem to be running on laser beams.
Laser beams, yes. Well, John Peel said of this album as well, in 1995, he said, if there's been anything in the history of popular music which could be described as a work of art in a way that people who are involved in other areas of art would understand, then Trackmark Replica is that. And 2 years later, he put it number one in his list of 20 favourite ever albums. And I think that in that quote, it's like not only something that's could be described as a work of art, but that phrase could be described as a work of art in a way that people who are involved in other works of art would understand.
Mm.
So I think if you think of it like a Jackson Pollock painting or a Mark Rothko thing with just like big patches of colour and very abstract, or, you know, Marcel Duchamp's urinal in a gallery, you know, if you think of it like that, rather than thinking of it as a conventional painting that's of something, then I can see what he means with that.
See, what's interesting for me is that I think underneath it could have been recorded as a quite accessible album, in the sense that if the music had been standard fare,
mm-hmm.
it would have weird lyrics on top of it. You'd think, well, that's that kind of works, and I know I sent you the clip of Beefheart playing with Frank Zappa on sort of live in a radio show. I can't remember where it was. It was 75 it was. And they played Orange Claw Hammer.
Yes.
Which on the album is just a cappella.
Yes.
But he played that with Frank Zappa playing the guitar. And it's quite a nice guitar as well. I mean, it's not your polyrhythmic all over the place, dust blues, whatever it is.
Actual chords. Yeah.
Actual chords that you would recognise. And it really works. I think it's a brilliant song.
Yeah, but I think that's what I mean about Backchain Puller.
But would you
Puller.
Want an album of that? I don't know if you would want an album of that.
Well, that's why I prefer Backchain Puller, because that more or less is that. The album, the music's not... It's still quite abstract, but it's nowhere near as abstract. The reason why the music ends up like that is because, basically, Captain Beefheart came up with a lot of the ideas on the piano, but he can't actually play the piano. So he was just bashing out little sort of ideas, and then John Drumbo French was transcribing those ideas, and it was definitely his job to piece them together into some kind of form that might make some kind of sense, and then teach it to the rest of the band.
Didn't he also record his vocals without listening to the music?
He did, yes, but without you know, putting headphones on.
Yeah. I mean, that's not helpful, really, is it?
No, he didn't use headphones at all. So he sang in time to the reverberations in the studio. but, I mean, he could hear a little bit of it bleeding through the headphones on the other side of the room kind of thing. Beefheart has made out that all of this album is totally his creation. And, in fact, he said in the past, much to the upset of the various Magic Band members... that he claimed in a TV interview that he took a group of non-musicians and taught them to play. Not true. They were already very well-established musicians. And how would Beefheart teach them to play anyway? Because he can't play anything apart from the
harmony. I mean, I think this album, if nothing else, it shows how good the musicians are.
Exactly. Well, they spent 8 months, like we say, 18-hour day, spent playing and rehearsing this music. Here's John French, a quote from him. It was indeed a torturous experience. I've never worked that hard and that intensely on anything since. It's a bit difficult to keep a balanced mental state in that kind of suppressed environment. Don had usurped nearly total control and replaced all the previous guys with younger musicians. We were all a bit naive and easily led. I'll talk later about the sort of cult-like living they were doing, but just on the music and how they were all kind of... some of the people that left the Magic Band were a little more traditional musicians, and because they were older, they had families, and they were a little bit more about wanting to make some money. But these guys that they got in now were younger and taking a lot of hallucinogenics, and were much more sort of open-minded music-wise. So they were up for absolutely anything. But when they came to record the album... They were so meticulously rehearsed from these, very long period of very intense... The instrumentals for the double album were recorded in one single six-hour recording session. So to work that fast is almost unbelievable that they could record that music in that time. And once you take into consideration the complexity of the music, that just seems impossible. Impossible. Yeah. The musicianship is extraordinary. And Jeff Cotton said in one of his interviews that he'd be interested in hearing, because Beefheart's vocals are generally very forward in the mix, and he would be interested in hearing a bit more of the band on some of the songs, which I kind of agree with. I really like that instrumental song that's on there, the total instrumental.
Hair Ply Bake?
No, not that one. No, there's another one. Darley's car. Hair Pie Bake. There's Hair Pie Bake 1 and Hair Pie Bake 2. The first one I can't get on with at all, but anyway, we'll talk a bit about the individual songs a bit later, but I want to talk about the atmosphere in the recording of it and this kind of cult-like stuff, because
is it a bit like when, because did we talked a little bit about when we did Forever Changes, we talked about Arthur Lee having everybody living in the house and bossing them around and stuff. Is it like an extension of that? Is it like an intense version of that, would you say?
Well, yeah, much more intense and much more unpleasant, really, I think. Beefheart was only there for about 5% of the time, apparently, when the band were rehearsing. The rest of the time he was sleeping. And they were in this house.
He was sleeping for 18 hours a day.
He wasn't there. He wasn't there when they were doing this practicing. About 5% of the time he would turn up. But Jeff Cotton talking here. Don did not like to perform. In fact, I think he was scared shitless most of the time. That's probably why he wouldn't even come out to rehearse with us 96% of the time, because then he would have to sing the songs and he would have to act like he knew what he was doing and he didn't have a clue. He then talks about how the other band members had to cue him in. He didn't know where to put his parts in. When he gave John the parts, that's Drumbo French, he had no clue of how it was going to go together, what it was going to sound like. So he would very seldom come out, okay? And he would never change the parts because he didn't have a clue of what was in there in the first place. And then Jeff Cotton goes on to explain what he did come out to see the band for. It was most of the time, it was just, we got some shit going on with you guys, come in here. This guy's an arsehole, it's time for us to get on his case. Now, it seems there's this movement, so-called religious movement, that Don was quite influenced by. This religious movement called Synanon, founded in 1958 by a guy called...
I like their swirly things with the white, very very thick icing on the top.
That's cinnamon. That's cinnamon. This is Synanon. So I can see where the mistake you've made there. It was founded in 1958 by Charles Dederich Sr. in Santa Monica, California. It was originally established as a drug rehab program, but it developed into this alternative community centered on a group truth-telling sessions that came to be known as The Game, which is a form of attack therapy. And the idea is that you strip down everyone's defense mechanisms and through humiliation and hostility, one person at a time. John Drumbo French says, the only one who was never in the firing line, so to speak, was Don. We were all targets of these talks that Don initiated, and we would focus on one individual at a time. It was embarrassing and humiliating, which was, I suppose, the point. To reduce us through fear to submission by convincing us we weren't worthy at all. And Jeff Cotton talks about like long sessions in bathrooms with water being sprayed on people and stuff like that. I mean, it's really quite unpleasant and criminal, really. It is criminal behaviour. So I just thought that was worth acknowledging, at least, because.
So this album is the third with the Magic Band.
Yeah.
They made subsequent albums with him then. So despite all this unpleasant behaviour, they stayed with him.
Most of them didn't stay with him after this album, and John French didn't stay with him. He came back later, agreed, but he left after this album. It's interesting listening to Jeff Cotton, who's had like years of therapy and all this kind of stuff. But he said, you know, when I came into the band, I really thought a lot of Don. I loved him. Unfortunately, some people take others well-meaning and they use it for their own ends. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I've said this before, so why not? Charles Manson was a very powerful individual and he took a lot of people down with him. I consider Don to be much stronger than Manson, much more powerful mentally. It was trauma built upon that scene after scene after scene, bathroom, time upon time, layer upon layer. So it says he's forgiven him. I didn't get the impression that John French has forgiven him. They're all kind of quite badly mentally scarred. In terms of like why they stayed there or rejoined the band later, I mean, lots of people who are abused go back to the person who abuses them, don't they?
I suppose that is true.
So
that brought everything down, hasn't it?
He as well as being sort of emotionally and psychologically abusive and physically abusive, he pushed John French down the stairs at one point, and he gets the band members to like.
Did he record that as part of the percussion that we hear?
But he gets the band members to beat up other band members and stuff like that when he's He deliberately deprived them of sleep and food, gave them one cup of soybeans, hence the beans thing, one cup of soybeans a day. and like I say, it left them in very poor mental and physical health, and I think it crosses the line into being criminal behaviour myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't know that.
Has that tainted your impression of the album then?
Well, I didn't have a great impression of the album anyway. I mentioned on the last podcast my holiday in Holland where we heard...
Yeah, the reason you don't like it is you're not taking enough drugs anymore.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Because I mentioned how I was on that road trip in Holland and we heard some Captain Beefheart. I thought it was amazing. So I came back to London and bought... Yeah. Trout Mask Replica, took that home and thought, well, that doesn't sound anything like the bluesy stuff that I liked in Holland. And but that was a long time ago. That's like, I don't know, 25 years ago, and I've still got the CD. So and every couple of years I get it out and put it on, and maybe this will be the time that it clicks, maybe this will be the time I like it. But I've never listened to it like, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 times in a couple of weeks like I have done in preparation for this. I still don't like it. I admire it. I admire the musicianship is amazing, and the lyrics are amazing.
I think the lyrics are just incredible, and the musicianship, I can tell that they know what they're doing, but I don't really like it. And I think the songs that I like best on it are the ones that are perhaps more traditional in terms of composition musically, or even with no music at all.
Yes. The other thing is, it's I know it's a single CD, but a double album. But every time I listen to it, I get after about, you know, I get to a certain point and I think, well, it must be nearly finished now. It must be nearly finished. Man, it goes on. It goes on. I mean, does any... double album really need to be 28 songs long?
There's an argument that any double album could be a better single album.
Okay,
we talked about that with the White Album.
We did talk about the White Album's 30 songs, but even that doesn't seem as long as this.
I think it is a test of endurance, and I think I definitely found that as I turned over the second LP. this is quite hard going, and to give the later songs a fairer listen, I started listening to it the other way around. So I'd listen to sides 3 and 4 first,
yes,
and then 1 and 2, just because otherwise it's that second LP is coloured by the fact that my listening has gone through the first album already.
Yes. Well, each time I've listened to it, I've then gone and listened to another of my favourite double albums afterwards to kind of almost get the taste out of my mouth.
Quadrophenia, then, you've been listening to a lot of it.
Well, I have listened to Quadrophenia, Sign of the Times. None of these have got 28 songs on them, by the way. The best one I found as a little palate cleanser after listening to this album, listen to the whole of Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life.
Yeah. Would you say that's the direct?
It's kind of like the direct opposite of this, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
I also found.
Well, let's talk about some of the songs because I'm gonna suggest that there are some good songs on it, and I you know, in the past and even now I've been known to put together compilations and I have included Beefheart and I have included stuff off this, for example. Orange Claw Hammer, those would both be good openers, I think, to a good mix.
Well, is the vocals only one of the vocals only one, isn't it?
And Orange Claw Hammer. They're both are, actually. They both are. Yeah.
Yeah. I like. Well, I wouldn't say I like them, but excuse me.
Allergic to Beefheart.
Yeah. I like the instrumental one. I like some of the songs that have got instrumental sections in them, and I like the ones that are vocals only. Orange Claw Hammer is a kind of seafaring tale, isn't it? And Well, that's the other one with no instruments on it.
Yeah.
It's just two notes, just two notes, a minor third apart, and it goes all that stuff about the birds and then the feathers of solid chrome and the beaks of solid bone. I like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about Ella Guru? Ella Guru is perhaps one of the more accessible tunes.
It's got rhythmic wise. It's got like a fairly regular 4/4 rhythm, and it's up to that point of the album, it's definitely the closest you've got to something you could actually sing along with. It's kind of got a chorus.
He knows all the colours that nature do.
Yeah. It's kind of got a bit of a chorus, isn't it? That one.
Yeah. Well, and I know you and I have been listening to this tribute album, Fast and Bulbous.
Yes.
And XTC do a version of Ella Guru that actually is, I would say, 100% faithful to it.
It is, yeah. And Andy Partridge really sounds like Captain Beefheart on that version, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that album, it's interesting that there's only a couple of songs of, only a couple of bands choose to cover songs from Trackmask Replica on there, and that one and one other. I think the other songs that work best
are China Pig.
China Pig, yeah. Like that Petrol Emotion one, is a song called Hothead or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what album that's off, but it's like really good. Doing a cover of one of these songs off this album is going to be hard, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Ella Guru, you're going to say is all right. What about Pachuco Cadaver? Do you like that one?
Yes, that's one of the ones. I've basically got some songs that you're naming the same ones on the whole. The ones that I thought were more bearable than the rest.
Mm.
Yeah. Pachuco Cadaver, however you say it.
Chroma Seltzer Blue Umbrella keeps her off the ground. I mean, you can't argue with that, can you?
You can't argue with any of this stuff. And that's where the squid eating dough in a polyethylene bag.
That's right, yeah.
Comes up. Yeah. 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 And Pachuco is apparently members of a sort of counterculture from El Paso in Texas in the late 1930s. Sort of Mexican Americans who dress in fancy zoot suits and listen to jazz and swing music.
Oh. Yeah,
not that I can understand what that's got to do with a squid.
Good knowledge.
Yeah.
Sugar and Spikes, I like as well. I think that song almost could fit on the first album.
It's one of the older songs on the album, apparently.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it has got a bit more of a conventional structure and sound to it. Yeah, there was three songs that were recorded before the main Trackmask sessions, which were that one, Sugar and Spikes, Veterans Day Poppy, and Moonlight on Vermont.
Well, Moonlight on Vermont is often held up as the stellar track on this album. What do you make of that one?
Well, I thought it was interesting. The lyrics are interesting because it's got a couple of... It's got that bit where it sings Give Me That Old Time Religion, which is a traditional sort of black spiritual song dated back to the 1800s. And it's also got the repeated phrase Come Out to Show Them, which I think is a definite reference to Come Out by Steve Reich, which had been released in 1966 and includes a sample of a voice from an interview with a young African-American man, one of the alleged Harlem Six, who was a victim of a brutal police beating in 1964. And the phrase Come Out to Show Them was Ham explaining how after the beating, the police wouldn't allow him to receive medical treatment because he was bruised but not bleeding. So this Ham fella had to say, basically had to force proof from his body that he was injured. And the quote is, I had to like open the bruise up and let some of the bruised blood come out to show them. So I wonder if Beefheart was trying to link that incident with the old Negro spiritual.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe.
So I thought that was interesting.
I like that one. I think the singing on it is pretty tuneful.
It is, but I mean, also the title "Moonlight on Vermont" is clearly a play on "Moonlight in Vermont," which is an old jazz standard recorded by many different people. But the version I know is by Frank Sinatra, and I would rather listen to Frank Sinatra sing "Moonlight in Vermont" 28 times than listen to the 28 songs on this album.
What about Old Fart at Play? The Old Fart Was Smart. Isn't that... That's some good storytelling on that one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's near the end of the album, isn't it?
Yeah, penultimate song, actually.
Yeah, he says something about wearing a fish head, doesn't he, in the song?
Yes, that's right.
So maybe he's talking about himself. And he yeah. says trout replica on the in this song, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think that's a good one. So I mean, I think I've mentioned all the ones that I particularly like.
I think I think the only one I like Ant-Man B, mainly like it because it's got quite a long instrumental section at the end. And I really like Darley's Car, which is the just the two guitars going at it. It's another instrumental song.
But Ant-Man B is interesting. I'm not particularly keen on it, but I like the idea of it being about ant wars.
Well, I didn't even notice the lyrics, to be honest, but there's a two-minute bit at the end where the band are playing instrumentally. It's got some good sax playing, actual sax playing, rather than the free jazz weird sax playing that's on a lot of it. And I just like that bit. They get that bit sounds like, oh, I'd quite like to be in a studio watching them play that. That sounds quite good, that bit.
Do you think, having you know, given it a good shot, do you think you could recommend it as an album that other people, if they've not heard it, they should listen to?
Well, during my research period, I have... it's the school holidays, isn't it? So I have been in the car with my kids at various points.
With the doors locked.
And I was given my oldest son, who's 14... and one of his mates. I was giving them a lift the other day, and they're big music fans. They play music together. They're both guitarists, and I put it on to see what they thought of it. They didn't like it. They didn't like it at all.
I wasn't asking whether you think they'd like it. I'm asking whether you think they should listen to it.
Whether they should listen to it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I would really. I'd say they should listen to some Captain Beefheart.
Yeah,
listen to that. Broaden your horizons a bit. Listen.
Not necessarily this album.
Not necessarily all of this album.
Mm.
No, but I also know what you were saying about because mentioned it about being the school holidays. So you know you're saying about how these phrases are getting into your head. So because it's the school holidays this morning, before we started recording this, I've been to the zoo with my kids.
Oh, yes.
And I saw an animal called are you familiar with Babirusa? Northern Babirusa? Mm-hmm. It's a kind of pig kind of animal with tusks.
Okay.
And I think it lives in somewhere over sort of Indian Ocean kind of area. There was a little sign next to it, and it said long snout. So it's got long snout for sniffing out fruit, fungi, insects and small animals. Unlike other species of pigs, they have no snout disc cartilage, which means they can't root for food. And I just get really obsessed with the phrase snout disc cartilage. It sounds like that would be like the initial, you know, the first draft of what they were going to call this album.
Well, I mean, before we get to deciding how we're going to grade this, and I think it's very difficult to grade because it is unlike anything else really that I've listened to him, and I've tried to teach myself to like jazz as well, and I'm going through the list of 100 jazz albums that shook the world, which was done by Jazzwise, and I'm about halfway through that, and I like some of them and I don't like some of them, but you know I'm not sure that I'm necessarily educating my musical palate. But this is a one-off, and I think it's very difficult, therefore, to you know sort of rank it with anything else in mind. But anyway, before we do that, because we are going to do that, I know, I wanted to let you know that Robert Pollard, who is the reason we're listening to this this album, because it's one of his tapes, obviously, is a big fan of this album. So it turns out. And on the blog post, I'm going to put up a picture of him wearing a Fast and Bulbous T-shirt that was found by someone on the Guided by Voices forum. So thanks to Esteban Entwistle for that. And he said that in conversation with Robert Pollard has, of course, 10 copies of this album.
Cool. How many have you got?
I've got one.
Yeah. Have you got like a vinyl copy?
It's a vinyl copy. There you go. There's a vinyl copy there.
It's great. This is great for an audio podcast, isn't it?
It's not an old one. It's a repress, but it's got a really good cover on it because the the picture had got lost, apparently. So a lot of the sort of CD covers and early represses have got faded pictures or blurry pictures on the front. But this is a really... You couldn't get a clearer picture of a trout mask if you wanted.
You could, actually, because apparently it's not a trout.
Oh, is it?
Apparently it's a salmon.
Is it?
But it's a replica of a trout in some way. I don't know. I don't know how closely related salmons and trouts are, but apparently it's a salmon head, not a trout head that he's wearing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, do you want to tell me what you're grading this album at?
Well, yeah, I can, but it's going to take a while because I'm... Basically, there's about a quarter of the songs on the album that I find bearable, more bearable than the rest.
Only a quarter?
Yeah, so Dali's Car, I've mentioned, Ant-Man B, Orange Claw Hammer and Well, which are the two vocals only one, Ella Guru, Moonlight on Vermont, Pachico Cadaver and Veterans Day Poppy. I quite like the lyrics in Veterans Day Poppy. If I only like a quarter of the songs, then the most I could give it is a quarter of 10 out of 10, which is 2.5. But I don't really like a quarter of the songs. I just find them more bearable and less irritating than the other songs. So I can't give it 2.5, but I'm going to give it 1.5. But then I want to add some extra points for it being innovative and original, because it is very comfortably the most innovative and original album we've listened to in this series by a million miles. Yeah. So I feel that should be recognised in my score. For that, and also for the incredible musicianship of the Magic Band, I'm going to add three more points to make it 4.5. But then there's the circumstances around the recording and the way that B-Fart did, albeit, and it should, important caveat, that B-Fart was suffering with a lot of mental health problems himself, but the way he treated those musicians sounds genuinely quite disturbing. So I'm going to take two of those points off. And we're going to end up with a final mark of 2.5.
Right, OK. Well, I'm glad you really thought about that. I'm not sure that I have to anywhere near that extent. I would say that there's, on each side of the double LP, there are at least two songs that I like. So on side A, so this is the one that starts with Frownland. I like Dust Blows Forward and Dust Blows Back. I like Ella Guru and I like Moonlight on Vermont. The next side, we've got Pachico, Pachico
Cadaver.
Yeah, and China Pig and My Human Gets Me Blues. I mean, this is quite a lot of stuff that I actually like. Side C, if you like, side three, Well, he's great. I love Well, and I really, really like Sugar and Spikes as well. The rest of that is not, more difficult. Then we've got Orange Claw Hammer, which is another big favourite. The Blimp, which we haven't talked about. It's the Blimp, Frank, the Blimp! which, again, is something that I've said more than once over the last 2 weeks. Then Old Fart at Play, Veterans Day, Poppy, I like all that. So I would say there's probably about half of it I like. So if I'm using your scoring system, I would say that that's a 5 right there, right? Then I've got to add in the weirdness, which I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
So that I'm taking it up there to 6. I didn't know about him being a complete bastard, so I'm not taking anything off. I like the fact that sometimes I found myself sat on the bus listening to Trout Mask Replica very loudly, and looking at other people on the bus, sort of going about their mundane, humdrum lives, thinking if they could hear what I'm hearing, if they were forced to have that playing out loud on the bus, it would drive everyone insane. And I really like that. So I'm going to give it another point, and I'm going to give it 7.
Wow. So have you tried writing to Liverpool City Council and suggesting the pipe Trout Mask Replica through the PA systems of their buses?
To empty them. But it is a challenge, and I've really enjoyed listening to it, but I'm quite happy to say I may well not listen to this album again for another few years.
Well, I'm quite happy to say that because it's... we've done like two programmes in a row on B-Fart now, and I've gone off to listen to some of the later albums that I'd never ever heard before. and I like them, you know. So yeah. The discovery, I thought that maybe by repeated listening to this album, I might like it more than I did, but I don't. But I have discovered some other later albums that I think are really fantastic, and I've got a few more to listen to as well. So.
Well, I like those later albums. As you say, Clear Spot is my favourite by a long while, and that's mostly because it's got Her Eyes Are a Blue Million Miles and Big Eyed Beans from Venus, which are my two of my top five Beefheart favourite tracks. The others would be probably Electricity, Ice Cream for Crow, and if I'm going beyond five now, but Diddy single I really like as well. I love his vocal on that. A Carrot Is As Close As a Rabbit Gets to a Diamond, that's another great song. Anyway, we're not really talking about those other albums, but nevertheless, do listen to Beefheart, even if you don't like this.
Well, the one I don't know of those ones you just mentioned is the Carrot one. What album is that from?
I think that's on Doc.
Radar Station, is it?
Yeah, I haven't
listened to that one yet. Right, I might give that one a listen next then.
Yeah, it's an instrumental.
Talking of next, what's
next
episode?
Well, next tape 39. We're really whizzing through these tapes now, aren't we? It's going to be odd because it's a single album show because it's a single album tape, but the album is only 9 tracks long, I think. So we've only got 9, not 28 to listen to. And it's Groundhogs. Thank Christ for the Bomb, said everyone on the Liverpool bus.
Robert Pollard's Guide to the Late 60s is a Trust the Wizards production. You can find out more at pollard60s.com and on Twitter at pollard60s. If you liked it, then please subscribe and review wherever you get your podcasts. You may also enjoy their other podcast, which you can find at trustthewizards.com. Original music by the Malibu Storks. Kika Revels and Chorizo Garbanzo are currently appearing in Waiting for Godot at the Mail Theatre in Leeds.